Good morning and welcome to all of you as well. Today I'm representing, as you can see, a few co-authors, one of which is based in Atlanta with me, and two who are one from our country office in Sierra Leone and another from Indonesia who were unable to join us. I have no financial relationships to disclose. So my presentation today is going to include an overview and a background on the window of opportunity, including what this means for CARE's work. I'm also going to go over the methods and outcomes for the baseline quantitative and qualitative research that we have completed to date in three countries, and also provide an overview of how all of this links to addressing issues of social injustice within the communities we work. So the window of opportunity. In 2006, the World Bank released a pivotal document for the international development community that brought together years of research to confirm that if we truly wanted to address the underlying factors of economic development and education attainment, that we needed to concentrate our efforts on improving the nutritional well-being from pre-pregnancy through a child's first 2 years of life. This period of time is known as the window of opportunity. In 2008, the Lancet series on maternal and child undernutrition brought together leading researchers to emphasize the importance of this particular period of time in development in terms of truly addressing intergenerational aspects of malnutrition and working with communities to ensure that they have children better prepared for opportunities in the future. Here presented are some of the evidence-based interventions that were reported in the third paper in the series by Bhutta et al. So the window of opportunity at CARE. CARE's window of opportunity program is a privately funded infant, young child, and maternal nutrition project that focuses on the promotion, protection, and support of optimal feeding practices. It is a 5-year program and began in 2008, and we have secured funding through 2012. Strategies to achieve this include working to improve the enabling environment, strengthening the health system, and empowering communities and individuals to make appropriate choices regarding their nutritional well-being. Globally, the project works in 5 countries: Bangladesh and Indonesia in Asia, Nicaragua and Peru in Central and South America, and Sierra Leone in Africa. Startup in each of these countries has been staggered since 2008 in order to ensure adequate technical guidance and support in incorporation of lessons learned. There is a planned extension into a small number of African countries with strong food security portfolios. The Window of Opportunity Project overall is grounded in a social and behavioral change process that focuses on supporting mothers, communities, in order to support them to make optimal infant, young child feeding choices, as well as support related maternal nutrition practices. In order to better understand how we've been able to facilitate this process, I'm going to be presenting to you the outcomes of our qualitative and quantitative research from Indonesia, Sierra Leone, and Nicaragua. So I'm just going to pause for a moment here so you can look at our results framework. Okay, so our quantitative methods. In each country, we began by doing a baseline cross-sectional survey that used the 8 core WHO IYCF indicators that came out in 2007. During the baseline assessments in the three countries, we piloted the use of the infant and young child feeding practices, collecting and using data step-by-step guide, which there are copies of the document on the back table if you're interested in learning more about it. But basically what the guide does is it helps program managers, consultants, whoever is facilitating an infant and young child feeding survey to be able to work to determine the best sample size, instrument to use, as well as it supports you on the actual facilitation of the analysis. So eligibility for participation in all of our countries' baselines was children under the age of 2 in a particular household based on the sample design. Each country, as part of the pilot, did receive technical support from a consultant at Boston University, our team in Atlanta, and to help us overcome some of the, I think that's actually my phone, my apologies. and to help us manage some of the translation and cultural issues on the ground level, we hired local consultants for that as well. All of our data was analyzed using SPSS. So in Indonesia, we did a census survey in two districts in West Timor with a total sample size of 1,634 children, 0 to 23 months. And this included intervention and non-intervention households. As you can see by the data we're presenting here, that Indonesia is, well, in particular West Timor, is prone to more chronic malnutrition based on rates of underweight and stunting. We can't ignore the fact, though, that wasting is still quite high and is actually quite vulnerable to the regular food fluctuations between access, availability, and utilization that take place out in West Timor. As I indicated earlier, we did collect data on all of the WHO indicators, all eight of them. However, these three are ones that across all three countries actually came out as quite low and actually relate very much to the qualitative results that I'll be discussing later in the presentation. In Nicaragua, we did a cluster sample in four districts. Reaching 1,152 children, 0 to 23 months, again in intervention and non-intervention households. The overall nutritional situation is not quite as dire as it is in Indonesia, but stunting does continue to remain an issue in Nicaragua and Central America. As well, there were also still some work that needs to be done in terms of infant and young child feeding practices. In Sierra Leone, we used a cluster sample and focused on 10 chiefdoms for a total of 900 children, 0 to 23 months, representing, once again, intervention and non-intervention households. Overall, Sierra Leone's results present a more acute situation with malnutrition as opposed to chronic, so very high rates of wasting and underweight. Again, similar outcomes in terms of the infant and young child feeding practices. Our qualitative methods. So for our qualitative work, we used standardized guides that we created in Atlanta based on literature and piloted and translated it in each country. In each of the countries, we did non-probability purposive sampling to better understand factors influencing our intervention targets. The initial qualitative work included focus group discussions in each of the countries, but based on the preliminary outcomes of these discussions, each of the countries explored further barriers and practices to infant and young child feeding and related maternal nutrition through a number of participatory research activities, which another colleague of mine will be presenting on later on in this session. Analysis was facilitated by the primary investigators for each of the countries, which has been shared amongst all of the co-authors. Our analysis was based on grounded theory, and we used Excel tables and charts. Some of the emerging themes across all the countries included care-seeking behavior, maternal eating patterns during pregnancy and lactation, breastfeeding practices, complementary feeding practices, sources of influence, and sources of support and care. So, though the qualitative results that I presented were a little bit more unique and situational based on each country's, what's happening in each country on the ground, our qualitative results indicated that though there can be some very specific contextual differences, there are still some very important similarities that link back to social structures, cultures, and norms. In all the countries, we see communities adhering to different food prescriptions or prohibited foods, as well as things women, infants, and young children are prescribed to eat to make them healthier or prevent women from getting too big in pregnancy so that they deliver children that are too large. Common food prescriptions in Sierra Leone included no animal protein for pregnant and lactating women, while in Indonesia, particular families are prescribed to eat certain proteins. So, for example, if you go to one household, they could all be living in the same village in the same cluster of homes, and one household might eat beans, but that might be their only protein source, while their neighbors will only eat fish and no other protein source. And so it even makes it a little difficult for us in terms of trying to focus our intervention and being able to support a community. We can't really approach it from a more general perspective, but a very individualized perspective. So barriers to infant and young child feedings, in addition to that, include a lack of information, knowledge and skills on appropriate feeding, but also fathers and senior women play an even greater role than most of this. In Indonesia, for instance, harmony must be maintained at all costs. It's a cultural norm. So fathers and senior women will often push the early introduction of complementary foods to silence a crying child. While in Sierra Leone, fathers refuse to have sex with their wives while they are breastfeeding. In all three countries, social hierarchies prevent most women who are in poverty from being viewed as authoritative. Health professionals often do not listen or work with mothers to support them to achieve optimal feeding practices, but tell them what to do with the anticipation that mothers will listen because the mothers do not know as much as the health professionals. Lastly, women's autonomy is lost often, in particular in patriarchal societies. In Nicaragua, men make the decisions about how households' income is used and when women are allowed to seek health services. Many women in the communities we work with acknowledge the importance of participating in community mobilization activities to improve their health outcomes or the health outcomes of their families, but their husbands often discourage them from participating in such activities. So in response to all of this, the window of opportunity has worked to contextualize its interventions to ensure that household-level interpersonal support is available. And that includes not just with mothers and fathers, but senior women, everyone who is participating in somehow the feeding practices at the household level. Adolescent girls, fathers, and senior women, in addition to mothers, are encouraged to attend peer support groups where they can discuss the challenges they face and disseminate positive experiences. Group education is catered to audiences based on the country, but all activities are intended to engage participants through movement, dialogue, such as cooking demonstrations, song, poetry, and skits. In order to achieve all of this, our capacity-building curriculums have been designed to be participatory in order to model from the beginning the desired practice for engagement, learning, sharing, and information dissemination. Lastly, we use our monitoring and evaluation systems to form our conversations with local, national partners, stakeholders, and government to advocate for better systems. So, kind of to summarize, what our experiences have taught us is that in order for us to better overcome malnutrition, we have to be able to look at social norms, structures, cultures, in particular food intake for women and children, IYCF support and promotion, the enabling environment, including systems, structures, and women's position. All of this has to be taken into consideration. And without attention to these particular issues and this holistic approach, women, young children, and infants will remain vulnerable to social injustice. Thank you. What our approaches have really taken into consideration is the positive deviance approach, the trials for improved practices, a lot of the well-researched and documented experiences from the international development community. Why we did not decide to go through and do the full PD Hirth model was, one, it's extremely time-consuming, and two, what we have found is that at times when you identify a particular mother in a community, that can stir up some jealousies And so you may not have the full participation and the full engagement of the community at the end of the day if you're sort of constantly identifying this one particular woman. So though we have that as our premise, and actually with our peer support groups, what we are doing with that model is working with communities to identify mothers or fathers or whoever who have had success at the household level to be facilitators of that group. However, the facilitation of that doesn't mean they necessarily come in and lead a session. What it means is more or less that they're just organizing the group and ensuring that everybody comes together and has a common place where they can come and share experiences.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about how, again, another programmatic question, in the day-to-day programming, the actual activities, you have addressed the social injustice, social structural
Well, that's a very good question. And actually, the way that the Window Project has been designed is to really look at things, as I mentioned earlier, through a social and behavior change process. And so not identifying and focusing on one activity like interpersonal support at the household or support groups, but how do we really use all of these activities together to address the underlying social injustices in the communities and provide women and families an opportunity to have a voice and be able to sort of explore what is the best place for them to be able to feel safe and feel that they can, that they have adequate justice and support in their behaviors and what they do.
Thank you.